We're here at the second day of Adelaide Writers Week 2012, and I've been fortunate enough to catch up this morning with Megan Abbott. Hello, Megan. Welcome to Adelaide.
Hello. Thanks
for the opportunity of speaking to you. Now, just a little bit about your own background for our listeners. Now, you're an award-winning author of 6 books, and you've been nominated for many awards. I won't go through them all because it just will take too long. But particularly, you won the Mystery Writers of America Edgar Allan Poe Award in 2008 for Queen Pin, which I also read, and nominated in 2010 for Bury Me Deep for Best Paperback, 2006 for Best First Novel, and 2008 you won the Barry Award. And you've been nominated 3 times for the Anthony Award. Some of those awards we don't sort of perhaps know too much about in Australia. But
I'm not sure I do.
But they're basically crime writing awards, aren't they?
And right.
That's been your particular focus
right. In
most of your writing.
Right.
And in your short stories too, you've contributed a number of short story collections as well. I'd like to talk today particularly about The End of Everything, which is your most recent book, which seems like a bit of a departure from what you've been doing, but I reckon it's a bit of a crime novel too, as well as being much more. I like this book very much, and I'm keen to sort of ask you a few questions about it.
Well, thank you.
The End of Everything, which has just been published, and published by Picador, which we'd probably point out. Now, The End of Everything was set in the 1980s. Can I ask why there was a reason for setting it particularly in the 1980s?
Well, it was funny. Originally, I thought I was setting it in the present day, but I was 13 in the 80s, and somehow that was suffusing the book, and it became clear to my editor as she was reading it that it was, this is really the 80s. It feels like, especially the early 80s in America, which was a period of somewhat of transition, and the sort of rise of what they call stranger danger in the States, which was, there were a lot of very public kidnappings.
Yes.
So it was a very particular time, and she felt that it felt like the 80s to her, and I knew why, because I was remembering myself at age 13. Mm. So I ended up just going with that and setting it.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I understand that now. Yeah. Now, it is quite a taboo topic. I mean, you really deal with the kidnapping of young girls by older men, in this case, Mr. Shaw. But there's a lot of sort of ambiguity here about who's to blame, and there's quite a little bit about, you write about the power of younger girls over older men, and perhaps a little bit about daughters' power over fathers too. So was that sort of ambiguity obviously a deliberate sort of thing for you?
Yes, I there's so little written, at least in American literature, about early female desire. And it is somehow taboo in itself that a 13-year-old, we think of 13-year-old boys, I think we feel very comfortable with, it's almost humorous that they would have sexual longings.
Yes.
I think people are very uncomfortable with thinking of girls that same age having that. And that the very natural feelings a girl can have at that age can be so exploited. But they have to be looked at, that it does play a part often in the way the young girls become involved with older men in ways they can't anticipate, because they're just having very natural exploratory desires.
Yes.
But an older man may not understand that is that nature of that desire, and that tension can cause, you know, great heartache, obviously. It felt a little nerve-wracking to pursue it, because there's a risk of blaming girls for these interactions, when it's really just quite a natural yearning.
So it's quite a fine line of sort of keeping that sort of balance, isn't it, without descending into, you know, blame, or into, I don't know what the other word is, but I wonder if there was, have you had sort of a reaction in America against the book?
No, I've had some people who, especially I've gotten some emails from people who were sort of struggling with, they almost wanted me to assure them that of, you know, my intent. You're really not supposed to talk about your intent when you're a writer. You know, you want the reader to read it
do
as
that.
They do.
Yeah.
But they seem so worried that I had an email from this week from a woman who'd read the book in Germany, and she wanted to give it to her 15-year-old daughter, but she wanted to make sure that what she believed to be the nature of the girl's relationship with these men was what I had meant. And I just sort of said yes.
Yeah.
she seemed relieved. Yeah. So it seems like, you know, this is maybe something many of us know on this sort of gut level, but articulating it makes us uncomfortable too. Mm. So we want to be assured that it's that this is okay.
Yes, yes. I like particularly the Tara and her coterie of commentators appearing like a bit like a Greek chorus, really. But I wonder whether they sort of, do they at all signify the sensationalist response of media and society in those sort of situations?
Yes, quite a bit, and also the... I'm always very interested in the sort of nastiness of young girls, which is also under discussed as much as young boys, and the way that girls can wield power through pretending to have more knowledge, you know, at that age, you know, that these girls, it's sensational. They're using the sort of sensational details to sort of, you know, rise in stature among their peers,
and
girls are notorious for that. So
yes,
I wanted a sort of example of that, and they really titillated and excited about it too, which is also one of the dangers in these scenarios. Is the girls can romanticize
and
glamorize
some of these
activities as well.
Yes, is it pushing it too much then to sort of see it as a bit of a symbolic media response, which can be in those media often does sensationalize and titillate, doesn't it, around that, which is not very helpful in those sorts of cases.
Right. No, it's quite true, yeah.
Judgment on the media, too?
I don't know if I would say it, because I think they wouldn't present it if we didn't want to hear it, you know? But it still remains that if it's a young, in America, it's a young white missing girl, she's in a tremendous, from the suburbs, gets a tremendous amount of media attention.
Yes, yes.
And that it does seem to be something about the visual aspect of showing the, you know, beautiful young blonde girl with the smile and the roller skates or something, you know, there's something very powerful about that. And I think, you know, the media, we are the media, really. So, you know, it's there's just, I guess our fascination with the story, it seems just as significant to me as the media's, I mean, perhaps exploitation of that fascination.
Yes. Well, I don't know whether you know, but Adelaide's got a bit of a reputation.
There's
a number of books written on some of the terrible crimes that actually have taken.
Kidnapping, missing children.
Yes.
I've been hearing about it. Everyone
mentions it. Yes, that's what we're famous
since I've been
for.
Here. it's so interesting because it's such a serene community, cases are very dramatic that I've been hearing about.
Yeah, but I think our crime rate's not as, you know, it's no bigger than anywhere else, luckily.
No, right, exactly.
But, you know, the media does sort of focus on that. Now, the girls themselves, these teenage girls, it seemed quite culpable too. Evie, you talk about a hollowed heart, and Lizzie's black heart. You know, you sort of give them a bit of a serve for their culpability too.
I guess it's, I wanted to grant girls at that age have a lot of complexity, you know, and, you know, they're not maybe as they appear, and it's a good thing, actually. I think that's sort of part of the growing up process.
Yes.
They're so much at that cusp age where they want to go to unsafe places, they want to experiment, they want to explore, but there's this sort of sense that they're doing something wrong because it's not expected of them. So I think really this notion of them having a black heart or a hollowed heart is that they feel that these desires are inappropriate and they have to be hidden.
Yes.
So there's a lot of hiding of, on all counts throughout the book, a lot of the characters sort of hiding their longings, feeling ashamed of them in some way.
Yes, yes. Now, you have built your reputation, your writing reputation, on your crime novels, and thinking particularly about Queenpin, which I went to read after I read this, and it was just such a terrific read. I just loved it.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Just a rollicking good story and great fun.
Oh, great.
But I wonder whether, could you say that The End of Everything is in some ways a crime novel too, even though it's a lot more, that there are some similar techniques. I sort of see Lizzie as perhaps the hard-boiled detective, you know, she's trying to sort of sort out the crime, trying to decide what's happened, and you think that's a fair summation?
Absolutely. I considered it a crime novel when I wrote it because I do consider her to sort of be in the, this is just an American thing, but a Nancy Drew, there's sort of a riff on the amateur girl detective because she has to find clues. And in fact, you know, she's very active in the investigation. And like most hard-boiled investigators, she becomes too involved in the investigation.
Yes.
So that structure gave me a map through the book. One of the reasons I love crime fiction so much is there is this sort of primal story arc, you know, of either succumbing to temptation and suffering the consequences, or seeking out justice and justice failing you. There are these core narratives that that I think always work, that they always speak to us because they're so primal. So I definitely wanted to have that, her sort of, her, it's really a, her kind of journey to adulthood in some ways, but it's also the solving the mystery of her own heart in some ways too. But and the solution to the solution she didn't ever want to know.
But she's like, you sort of built up the idea of the flawed female detective too. She's quite flawed too, isn't she?
Right. Yes. Yes.
She's consistent in that way.
Yes. Exactly. She cuts a lot of corners. She's not hard drinking, but but other than that, no. She her own desires interfere in some ways with she directs like a lot of hard boiled detectives in the classic form. They start to direct the investigation rather than sort of letting things unfold as we might see in Agatha Christie, for instance.
Yes. 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 Now, I read an article that you wrote, I think, for the Los Angeles Times magazine, Pretty Tough.
Oh, yes.
In which you talked about the female leads as outsiders, misfits, and sort of saying that Lizzie is perhaps one of them. She's very culpable in lots of ways. Mm-hmm. Are you sort of saying that the idea of the femme fatale is changing in crime literature, and perhaps you're contributing to that change?
I would hope. I think the femme fatale in general is really... it's really a projection of a male character's desire. It's not a real person, and I love femme fatale, so it's not a criticism, but I think that there's this ripe opportunity for more complicated women that are not merely projections or fantasies, but and that also aren't perfect. I think there is a tendency sometimes in novels now to swing the other way and make these very women who always do the right thing and are very strong and know how to shoot a gun, but also never make a mistake.
Yes.
And that that feels like just as much as a problem as the femme fatale to me, you know. So I it's really exciting lately to see this like a wider swath of opportunities for female characters to be, you know, black and white.
So I suppose it's about readers being able to engage with those sorts of people, because we can't engage with the perfect, you know, person. We can't engage with the totally disreputable person entirely either.
Somewhere
in between, we feel that, you know, there's a link, because that's what we're like. So
we want to drop ourselves in the book in some way, no matter what.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Males are certainly a threat, though, in this book. Even Mr. Verver, you know, is there's a certain ambiguity about his attentiveness to his daughter. There's a his daughter Dusty. There's quite a disturbing passage, I think, on page 246 about just his observation of his daughter. The males don't sort of come out of it too well, even the so-called sort of fathers, the good ones in the family.
Yes, he's the character I've gotten the most readers just wrestle with him quite a bit and come out on all sides. He's based somewhat on a father I knew as a young girl who was very much the romantic dad. We all wanted him to be our dad, but not exactly, because he was a Prince Charming too. He's very seductive without intending to. And my idea with Mr. Verver is he's very careless. Doesn't realize he so loves the attention of his daughter that he doesn't realize when he's just created a perfect man for her that no one will ever compete with. And he does, and he, you know, and so they're sort of in locked together somehow. And I think that can happen in families. The intensity is so great. And then you sort of see, I mean, I've known girls like this, and you see they have their daddy's girls an extreme, and you see the way life is going to go for them with the men in their life, because no one's ever going to be like daddy, because he's you know, treats them so well, you know. And so that's always been that dynamic that's interested me.
And there's such subtlety in the way the characters, you know, are portrayed. I mean, I think that's one of the wonderful things about it, but very non-judgmental too, you know. You don't judge them at all. This is just who they are, and this is part of who they are as human beings. Was that difficult to achieve?
No, it's funny. I'm so glad you say that, but people often have raised the issue with me. They feel that I should drop the hammer down on some of the characters, but I love them all. I interviewed Elmore Leonard recently for the Los Angeles Times, and he was talking about how he'd written only one villain ever in all his books. Of course, if we read, you know, he's a million villains in all his books, but there's one that he had written one book with a serial killer that he really hated, but other than that, he just loved them all. And I do kind of believe you have to love all your characters or they don't become real in some way. So it's hard for me even to You know, if someone criticizes Mr. Verba, I find myself saying, no, you don't understand.
Stand up for him. It's
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah, really. If you only knew him like I do, you know.
That's right.
So I think that that's, you know, it's a little less true saying Queenpin, which is a little more of the hard-boiled genre.
Yes,
it's a little,
yeah.
The main character in that book, I had a little bit of a problem with, but I still admired her pluck.
Yes. So, oh, she's such fun. That's
she is.
Great.
She's a climber, and I like to write books about the sort of American tradition of the hustler.
It's
always interested me.
So is this going to be sort of a new direction for you, do you think? I mean, a crime novel, but perhaps going deeper and pulling in other sorts of styles?
My next one that comes out here, I guess in May, is all set in the present day. And it's set, and you don't have these here cheerleaders in America.
No, but we know who they are.
You can't avoid them. Exactly. It's set on a high school cheerleading squad. And if End of Everything is about female desire at that age, this is about female aggression. And I kind of envisioned it as Richard III said in a cheerleading squad. So it's a struggle for power, a little like Queenpin in that way. So I guess the constant is, and there's a crime, but the constant is sort of this study of female complexity and darkness and the things we don't want to think about, our daughters or their mothers or their children. So I think that's going to remain the piece that goes
the
across
you'll be
them.
Exploring. Yes,
yeah.
Lovely. So why is this novel The End of Everything?
It's funny because it became such a it's such an ominous title.
That's right. Yes.
You know, especially in the world of publishing.
Do they know something I don't know?
Yeah. I guess it was so much about the end of childhood, I suppose, but the end of innocence, the end of illusion. Lizzie thinks she's figured it out and she's wrong about everything. And that moment is so powerful, and I don't think we only have it when we're adolescents, but it's especially painful when you realize that your dreams about the world and about men or women or they come shattering into pieces.
Yes.
And it's and everything also feels really big, so the title had to be really big, because when you're a 13-year-old girl, this is the end of everything. So
yes.
I wanted it to kind of capture that too.
Lovely. Probably just finish up by asking you, who are the crime writers that you read and that influence you, that you admire?
My biggest, especially in the more hard-boiled realm, was Raymond Chandler and James Ellroy of more recent vintage. They both have been huge influences on me, and I always sort of return to them. But I read pretty widely. Daniel Woodrell, I don't know if he's been published here, who wrote Winter's Bone that became the movie.
Oh, yes,
he's a big influence. I like a lot of Southern fiction.
Yes, yeah. Okay, well, we might just leave it there. Good time to finish. It's been wonderful speaking to you, Megan. Thank you for
Absolutely.
Spending the time
My
with
pleasure.
Us. Look forward to your next book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Something else first, and then I'm